Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett. Your host, Jimmy Akin, is our guest. Try to guess which one's wearing a cowboy hat. Well, who would you think, out of the two of us, which one's wearing a cowboy hat? I'll give you a clue. It could be both. It could be both. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've had a cowboy hat. I did have one in my youth, but I think I was kind of a phony in it. I mean, I'm a Southern California kid. I don't know what I was trying, but
lots of people in California wear cowboy hats.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But there's kind of two Southern Californias. One of them's near the beach where I grew up. It's a different culture. But anyways, we try things out.
Yeah, I don't. I also don't think in terms of things being phony. It's just a choice. If you choose to wear a cowboy hat, that's fine. If you choose not to, that's fine too.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It just seems more natural to an Arkansan than to a person who grew up next to the beach. But there it is. Anyways, it's Jimmy, by the way. The answer is Jimmy. Jimmy's wearing a cowboy hat. And all the questions are in for Jimmy. They all have come via the internet. And this one comes from Philip 325. What exactly is Paul referring to in Galatians chapter 3, verse 1, when he says Christ was publicly exhibited or portrayed as crucified? Is it possible Paul knew of the Shroud of Turin? Or maybe he's referring to early iconography of the crucifixion.
Well, assuming the Shroud of Turin is the actual burial cloth of Jesus Christ, it's possible that Paul knew about it. But I think it's very unlikely that that's what he's thinking about in Galatians 3:1. I also think that it's very unlikely he's thinking about early Christian iconography there. The word that he uses that gets translated as publicly exhibited or portrayed is prographo. And that has a couple of meanings in Greek. One meaning, as you might guess from just its etymology, you know, its word parts, pra is a preposition that means before. And grapho is a verb. It means I write. And so prographo would mean right ahead of time. So like if I was leaving instructions for while I'm on a trip, I might, you know, prographo my instructions. I'd write them ahead of time. But it also has a second meaning, which means more to do something publicly. But the focus is on verbal communication. If you look at the contexts in which prographo gets used, it may be used for written verbal communication, like to write publicly, or it may refer to spoken verbal communication, like to proclaim something. And that seems to be the obvious meaning here. It's very unlikely that we're talking about visual arts or the Shroud of Turin. The obvious meaning, given that Paul is a preacher who himself evangelized the Galatians, and that's what he's referring back to, is that he publicly proclaimed Jesus Christ to them as crucified. And this is an expected meaning of the term prographo. So if you have a text that clearly is talking about Paul's evangelization of the Galatians, and he's a preacher, and prographo covers the proclamations that Paul would have made to them of Jesus' crucifixion, then you don't need to go any further than that and propose anything more exotic. This seems perfectly straightforward. He's talking about his own original preaching to the Galatians of Christ crucified.
Philip, thank you. Thank you very much for the question. On we go to Daniel. In the story of Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5, could it be logically deduced that Peter was exercising the ability to retain sins?
Okay, so we probably ought to review what this account of Ananias and Sapphira says for people who may not be familiar. Basically, Ananias and Sapphira sell a piece of property, and they keep some of the money for themselves, and then they take the rest of the money and donate it to the early church. But in the process of donating it, they lie about it. And they say that, yeah, these are the proceeds that we got from selling that property, without disclosing the fact they kept some of the money for themselves. So they're saying we're given all the money, but really they're not given all the money. And Peter miraculously seems to know that, and he announces a doom on Ananias, who drops dead, and he says, "You haven't lied to men, but to God. You've lied to the Holy Spirit." And then when Ananias is carried out to be buried, his wife Sapphira comes in, and Peter pronounces a doom on her, and she dies too, and they take her off to be buried. So that's the context for the question of, could we deduce from this that Peter was exercising the ability to retain sins? Well, okay, so that ability is granted in John chapter 20, where Jesus tells the disciples, whoever sins you retain, they are whoever sins you forgive, they are forgiven. Whoever sins you retain, they are retained. I wouldn't say that there's no connection to that passage, but there's not an obvious connection. And this certainly is not an ordinary thing to occur. I mean, even when people lie to church officials and get caught, they normally don't end up dying. So this is already an extraordinary thing. And Peter's knowledge, and certainly Peter's malediction or announcements of doom on them, those are unique things that were done by the power of God, but are not normally part of the power of forgiven and retaining sins. Another crucial element that's missing here is confession. Because ordinarily, if you're going to forgive or retain a sin, you need the person to acknowledge the sin and you know, indicate, are they sorry for what they did? Do they intend to try to do better in the future or not? And so that element is missing here. There is nothing mentioned about either Ananias or Sapphira confessing their sin and saying, "Forgive me." And saying so insincerely, and then Peter says, "Sorry, you're not really sincere. I'm going to have to retain this sin." That doesn't happen here. So I wouldn't say that it's completely unrelated, but I would say that the account of Ananias and Sapphira is atypical and has other stuff going on in it that is, and thus does not reflect the ordinary exercise of the power to retain sins. It may involve it, but it's not the typical case.
All right. Thank you very much. I think I better take a break. That was Daniel. Thank you very much, Daniel.
If you feel you need one.
I do feel I need a little break. Yeah, I gotta mop my forehead a little bit. All right, I'm working hard here, Jimmy. Right back with more Jimmy Akin Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Catholic Influencers is a great podcast from Australia. It studies the weekly readings and breaks them down into layman's terms, showing you how they're relevant to our life today, making theology accessible for everyone. You can hear Catholic Influencers as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place, all free, at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click Podcast Central today.
All right, I'm recovered. I'm ready to go back to work. That was a good little break there. Took a nap, had a little snack. Jimmy Akin's our guest, and we got a whole bunch of questions because people love asking Jimmy questions however they can. Some of them come via the internet. This one comes from, can I read? mother-loving Christian. Yeah, you can say that. Mother-loving Christian, if Jesus was born in 3 or 4 BC and lived to be 33, would it be more accurate to say the crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension took place in AD 29 or 30, as opposed to the commonly cited AD 33?
Well, so we've got an assumption here. You know, Mother Loving Christian says if Jesus was born in 3 or 4 BC and lived to be 33, well, then math would point you towards the year 29 or 30. Yeah, it would be more accurate in that sense. You know, you've just assumed what year he was born, and you've just assumed that he lived to be 33. So, and given the fact there's no year zero in our timeline, you jump from 1 BC to AD 1. Well, that would, if he was born in 3 or 4 BC, then that would put his death in 29 or 30. But I, and that's just a simple matter of math. But I suspect what Mother Loving Christian is really asking is not a math question, but how plausible is it that he was born in, that he was crucified in 29 or 30 rather than 33. So I'm going to expand beyond the assumptions that the question makes in order to comment on that. The two dates that are commonly proposed for the crucifixion are AD 30 and AD 33. 29 does not work because Passover does not fall on the right day of the week, because we know Jesus was crucified on a Friday in conjunction with Passover, and that doesn't happen in AD 29. So in the right range of years, the two that are plausible are 30 and 33. So we need to find a way to distinguish between those if we want to determine what year Jesus would have been crucified. And I've done a lot of work on this. The starting point for that work is figuring out what year Jesus was born. And you do sometimes hear folks propose the year 4 BC or even earlier years like 6 or 7 BC, but those proposals are erroneous. They're based on the idea that Herod the Great, because we know Jesus was born in Herod the Great's reign, that Herod the Great died in 4 BC. And that is very commonly reported. It is also wrong. It's based on prioritizing certain material from the Jewish historian Josephus and handling it in an inappropriate way. I won't go into all that, but if we just stick to the data that we have in the New Testament, we come up with a different year for Jesus's birth. Luke, in Luke 2, says that, I'm sorry, at the beginning of Luke 3, says that the ministry of John the Baptist began in the 15th year of Augustus Caesar. And that would be either AD 28 or 29, depending on how you reckon exactly when that year began, because there were several different ways of reckoning it. He also says, and then he reports Jesus's ministry beginning just after John the Baptist. So this again would be in the AD 28 to 29 timeframe. He also says Jesus was about 30 when he began his ministry. So that could mean 30 exactly. It could mean 29. It could mean 31. It could mean 28. It could mean 32. But for estimation purposes, we'll stick with 30. So if you take the year 20, the years 28 and 29 as the plausible referent for the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, and you back up 30 years from that, mathematically, you would expect that to be 1 BC or 2 BC, except for the fact that there is no year zero. Like I said, we jump from 1 BC to AD 1. So you got to back up an extra year, and that puts us in 2 or 3 BC. And so we're in 2 or 3 BC for the birth of Jesus. And guess what? That is exactly the year that the majority of church fathers say Jesus was born in. They say he was born in in either the back half of 3 or the first half of 2 BC. And so we've got multiple independent confirmations of that from the church fathers. And so I think that's when he was born. So if Jesus is born in 2 or 3 BC and he begins his public ministry in 28 or 29, and we know from John that his public ministry goes on for multiple years, then AD 30 is not going to work. Because John records multiple Passovers that occurred during the ministry of Jesus, and Passover is always a year apart. So you've got multiple years, and that's going to take us past AD 30. And so AD 33, the traditional date, really is the one that's best supported by the evidence we've got.
Wow. It is an amazing bit of detective work, Jimmy. Every time I hear you review it, it's really something. Mother-loving Christian, I hope that clears it up for you. Next one comes from Aaron. Since Mary was preserved from original sin, did she experience sickness?
Maybe. We don't know. Now, just because you're free of original sin, that doesn't mean you're free from the sufferings of this life, because being free from original sin doesn't put you in a glorified state. So, for example, Jesus, he was free from original sin too. He was even free in a way that's superior to the way Mary was free. But that didn't stop Jesus from being physically assaulted. You know, you have the Romans and the Jewish soldiers. They were beaten on Jesus. They scourged him. They put a crown of thorns on him. They crucified him. They did physical damage to his body. So he wasn't in a glorified state that preserved him from physical damage. Okay, well, what is sickness? Well, sickness, as we discovered surprisingly recently, is caused by germs. This is what's known as the germ theory of disease. It's in contrast to other theories, such as humoral medicine, which says disease is caused by an imbalance in the humors of the body, or heroic medicine and things like that, or the miasma theory, which says sickness is caused by bad air and stuff like that. But it turns out, no, the majority of sicknesses are caused by germs, by microorganisms, either bacteria or viruses. And those are tiny creatures. So if it's possible for large-sized creatures to attack Jesus physically, it would be possible for small creatures, you know, to attack Jesus physically. It's not like there's a size cutoff somewhere. You know, if a Roman soldier can beat Jesus and attack him physically, well, a dog could run up and bite Jesus and attack him physically. And then a hermit crab could run up and pinch Jesus. And a barely visible microorganism, barely visible macroscopic organism, like a mosquito, could come up and drink some of Jesus's blood. And there's no scale cutoff here, so I have no reason to say that bacteria and viruses couldn't also attack Jesus. Now, God could miraculously preserve him from sickness, but that would be a separate gift than just freedom from original sin. And in the same way, the same thing would be true of Mary. A Roman soldier could beat her, a dog could bite her, a hermit crab could pinch her, a mosquito could bite her, or a tuberculosis bacterium could get in her lungs and attack her. So merely being free from original sin doesn't guarantee freedom from sickness. God could miraculously preserve her from sickness, but that would be a separate gift than just freedom from original sin.
Wow. All right. Aaron, thank you. Oh, wait, it says Aaron. I read that wrong. I can't believe I did that. That's an important part. Aaron, I apologize. I read that. Oh, man. I am not happy with myself right now. Wayward Templar 1314 asked, oh, that's dangerous. Wayward Templars are dangerous. If St. Joseph had children other than Jesus, as some traditions hold, why wouldn't they be the legal heirs to David's throne?
Because they didn't have God as their father. One of the things you find now, what Wayward Templar is contemplating here is the law of primogeniture. Primogeniture is a principle that applies in different ways in different cultures, but basically the firstborn has special rights. And there was a form of primogeniture in ancient Israelite culture. If you were the firstborn, typically what happened was you would inherit a double portion. So let's say you've got a family with three boys in it, and the firstborn boy, it gets a double portion when the father dies. So you take the estate, it's got three boys, you divide up the estate into four parts, you give two parts to the firstborn son and one part to the secondborn son and one part to the thirdborn son. So that's the typical way things happen. But it's not the only way things happen, because the father gets a vote here. And the father can look at the situation and say, for whatever reason, I don't want my firstborn son inheriting double. I want something else to happen. And we see leadership roles and promised lines of blessing pass into people in repeatedly in the book of Genesis to sons that are not the firstborn. That's why with Isaac and Ishmael, even though Ishmael is the older, Isaac is the one who inherits the line of promise. Similarly, when you have the twins, Jacob and Esau, and Esau is born first, nevertheless, Jacob is the one that inherits the line of the promise. Then when you get to the to Jacob's sons, to the 12 patriarchs, you would think that Reuben, who's the firstborn, is going to inherit the leadership role, but he doesn't, because he violated his father's marriage bed. And then you would think, okay, well, if Reuben has disqualified himself from leadership, it would then pass to Simeon or Levi. Ah, but they disqualified themselves by massacring some Canaanites. And so it ends up, the leadership role ends up passing to the tribe of Judah. And so we see multiple examples just in Genesis of how the firstborn does not always inherit. And so, and in these, in some of these cases, it's because the father, like Jacob said, I don't want Reuben and Levi and Simeon. They screwed up. I'm giving this to Judah. When you are Saint Joseph and you have some children, according to many traditions, and then you marry this consecrated virgin, and while she's a consecrated virgin, lo and behold, she gives birth to the Son of God, and it's prophesied he's the Jewish Messiah. Okay, you kind of go with that. He's the one who inherits the role of Messiah.
Yeah.
It's not someone else in the broader family.
That Wayward Templar, thank you very much for the question. Ask me anything, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Lots of great questions. Alistair asks this one, what is your take on Revelation chapter 6, verse 10? Alistair says he's from Bangalore, India. Cool, Alistair, thank you.
Yeah, that's also where Haji was from on the Johnny Quest show. He was from Bangalore.
Man, you know some detail. I don't know, like, that is the weirdest detail. I mean, I remember Haji. I love that show.
That was a great show.
Yeah.
Yeah. In any event, to address Alistair from Bangalore's question, so Revelation 6:10, we also always want to start by looking at the text. Now, this is in the part of Revelation where the Lamb is seated on the throne, and he's been brought this mysterious scroll that's written on both sides, which means God has a lot to say, because you normally only wrote on one side of a scroll back then. But this one is written on both sides, so it's what's known as an epistograph, which is a scroll that's written on both sides. So he's got this epistograph that's been given to him, and it's sealed with 12 seals, and he's popping the seals off to open it and learn what the scroll says. And as each seal comes off, there is an ominous judgment that happens. The first four seals are the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The first one represents a king. The second one represents warfare. The third one represents famine. And the fourth one represents death. So we've got conquest, war, famine, and death. And then he pops off the fifth seal. And we end up getting this passage in which we, and I'm gonna pull it up right quick just so I can read it. But he opens a fifth seal and it says, I saw under the altar, this is the altar in heaven, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slaughtered because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they held. And they cried out with a loud voice saying, this is verse 10, they cried out with a loud voice saying, how long, holy and true Lord, will you not avenge our blood? So that's a nice cliffhanger for us, and I'll give you the other side of that story on the other side of the break.
If that doesn't keep you listening, I don't know what will. That's a very good cliffhanger. All right, coming right back, Alistair, hang on there in Bangalore, and we'll get a completion of the answer from Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. There's that groovy music, which virtually always means Jimmy Akin is here with us nowadays. I don't know if we ever use it for anything else, but Jimmy is here. It's an Ask Me Anything, and we were in the midst of a pretty dramatic answer. What is your take on Revelation chapter 6, verse 10 was Alistair's question.
Yeah, so this is something that happens with the souls under the altar in heaven. They've been slaughtered because of the word of God and the testimony that they held. So these are Christian martyrs. And it says in verse 10, they cried out with a loud voice saying, how long, holy and true Lord, will you not judge and avenge our blood from those who live on the earth? So they're calling for justice to be done. Because there are people down on earth who have killed them. And those people are still running around down on earth. They haven't been held to justice yet. But in verse 11, it says that, and to each one of them was given a white robe, and it was said to them that they should rest yet a short time until the number of their fellow slaves and their brothers who were about to be killed as they had been were completed also. So basically, they're given a white robe to represent their Christian purity, and they're told to wait, that justice isn't going to happen just yet. There are some more people who are going to be martyred, and it'll be after that occurs that justice will be done. And I would say, in terms of, now I could could write a whole commentary on this, but I don't have time for that at the moment. But just to give my basic thoughts, I would say, well, you could read the verse in a sort of more bloodthirsty way, or you could read it in a more neutral way. The more bloodthirsty way would be, oh, these souls up in heaven, the martyrs, they are super mad. They really want vengeance. You know, they have this kind of bloodthirsty desire for vengeance. But I don't think that that's the case, because I don't think that's the best way to read the verse, because it can also be read more neutrally as they're calling for justice. And, you know, justice, if someone has been unjustly slaughtered for their Christian faith, well, justice needs to be done. You know, unless the person who killed them repents or something, there needs to be justice for that. And since the souls in heaven, literally speaking, are perfected in love, they're not really going to be bloodthirsty. So I would prefer the more neutral reading of their calling for justice. Now, how does this fit into history? Well, I think that the bulk of the material in Revelation, all of the material before chapter 20, occurred early in church history, either the first century or the first few centuries. So I would say that this represents, and especially given the fact that John says at the beginning and the end of the book that it's going to happen soon, that this reflects the first century persecution of Christians. And so I would say that what we're given is a symbolic, because Revelation is full of symbols, we're given a symbolic representation of the souls of first century Christian martyrs calling for justice to ultimately be done. But they're told they're going to have to wait a while. It's not yet time for that to happen. Are there actually souls up in heaven who were in the first century literally calling out in this way? Well, I would say this text is representing a truth, but I don't know that, like it says, they called out in a loud voice, kind of like a Greek chorus, you know, where you have all the people speaking in unison together. How long, holy and true Lord, will you not judge and avenge our blood from those who live on the earth? Okay, there's no way people are going to all say the same thing at the same time unless they're reading from a script. And there's no mention of a script here. So I would say this is a non-literal representation of the literal thirst for justice that people who have been martyred for their faith have. So those would be my preliminary thoughts on Revelation 6:10.
All right, Alistair, I hope that was helpful to you. Let's see, this next one would like to know something. Sapere aude. Is it?
Aude.
Aude, sapere aude. Oh yeah, you got to pronounce that last E in Latin. Sapere aude 6935 wants to know, how authoritative are the pontifical biblical commission's early decrees on traditional authorship? For example, in 1914, the PBC declared Paul wrote Hebrews. Now the PBC is not part of the magisterium, but at the time of these declarations, it was. It seems like almost no Catholic scholar nowadays thinks Paul wrote Hebrews, but I don't understand why the PBC's earlier declarations are no longer authoritative, including supporting Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch, supporting Matthean priority, etc.
Okay, so if memory serves, what the Pontifical Biblical Commission said back in 1914 was that the arguments that Paul did not write Hebrews were not sufficient to overcome those that favored him writing it. To answer the basic question, and this is something that has been talked about by I'll give you a resource that hits all these sources. I talk about this in my book, Teaching with Authority. I cover the Pontifical Biblical Commission and the status of its early replies on these questions, and there is a bit of a history here. By the mid-20th century, the status of these early answers had changed. They were authoritative when they came out. But then there was a bunch of further investigation and discussion and scholarship that got done. And by the mid-20th century, before the Second Vatican Council, the question came up about, are a lot of these still authoritative? And the ruling that came back was, actually, they don't prevent further exploration of these questions and so forth. And the Vatican started walking them back. And then the Pontifical Biblical Commission ceased to be part of the magisterium in the 1960s after the reforms of Paul VI. And subsequent to that, then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who was the head of the Pontifical Biblical Commission, and later Cardinal William Levada, who was the later head of the Pontifical Biblical Commission, both confirmed that the early decrees have been retired, that they are no longer authoritative. And basically, it's because they were always cautionary decrees. They were not doctrinal decrees. They were cautionary, and it was eventually concluded the reasons for the caution were had been dealt with. It wasn't gonna destroy the authority of the Book of Hebrews if it turned out someone other than Paul wrote it. It wasn't gonna, you know, shake the faith of Christendom itself if it turned out Paul didn't write it. Mm-hmm. And so there was more flexibility on these, and the church allowed that flexibility to proceed. So, and in fact, you even find, I haven't published this, but I did a study of those early decrees, and then because they also dealt with other things like who wrote the Book of Isaiah, and they supported a single Isaiah theory and rejected the Deutero and Trito Isaiah theories. But by the time of John Paul II, he's talking about Proto Isaiah and Deutero Isaiah and Trito Isaiah, and you can document how popes themselves mm-hmm. are embracing positions that are at variance with the early Pontifical Biblical Commission stuff, and that's just further evidence that they have ceased to be authoritative. And that occurred as a process that began by the mid-20th century and was completed by the end of the 20th century.
Thank you, Sapere Aude, very much for the question. This one comes from Blue Rose Lion 5243. I was talking to a fallen away Catholic. How do you respond when they say Adam had a first wife named Lilith and Eve was his second wife?
Well, I'd say that's folklore. That's Jewish folklore. No scholars take that seriously. Christian scholars do not take that seriously. Jewish scholars do not take that seriously. Secular scholars do not take that seriously. This is simply folklore that came along in the Middle Ages, and so it doesn't have a historical basis. If they want to say it does, I would challenge them to find there's nothing in the Bible about Adam having a first wife named Lilith. And if you want to say that it was part of the biblical worldview, you're going to need to find some other comparable ancient source that, you know, is part of Israelite literature that both mentions Lilith and identifies her as Adam's first wife. And that doesn't exist until the Middle Ages. So this is a part of later folklore. It has no historical value other than telling us something about what certain Jewish people, you know, entertained as a folk belief in a later age.
Thanks, Blue Rose Lion. That'll take us to the break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1999. The shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament of Our Lady of the Angels Monastery in Hansville, Alabama is consecrated. Mother Angelica says, "The happiest day of my life was the day this church was dedicated."
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Well, time is flying here. It usually does when Jimmy's around and we're having fun answering internet questions, and that's what we're doing today. Jimmy has provided us with a whole bunch of questions that he has gotten via the internet, and this one comes from Mr. E, 8432. Mr. E wants to know, I understand if a couple divorces legally, they're still married in the eyes of the church. If one wanted to get remarried, they would have to get an annulment from the church. But suppose that marriage produced children. What does the annulment mean for the children of that marriage as far as the church is concerned? Or another way of putting it, if my parents got annulments from the church, does the church still recognize me as a baptized Catholic? Or do I suddenly become a bastard child, for lack of a better term?
Well, I'm happy to help Mr. E with this mystery. Yeah, I see what he did there. Mm-hmm. It's a question that people wonder about, and frankly, they don't need to be worried. What does it mean to the children if your parents got an annulment? It would mean basically nothing. So for the first point he asked about, would you still be regarded as a baptized Catholic? The answer is, of course you would. You were baptized in the Catholic Church, so you are a baptized Catholic. Whether your parents were married or not, in God's eyes, has nothing to do with whether you're a baptized Catholic. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you're a baptized Catholic. Would he suddenly become illegitimate? Almost certainly no. The reason is that legitimacy is a legal concept that's part of human law. It has nothing to do with divine law. It's used in human law to determine various things like inheritance rights. The children who are to use the terminology, even though it's unfortunate, the legitimate children, like, inherit, but then if dad had an affair and there's another child on the side who was never part of the family who's illegitimate, that child doesn't have the same inheritance rights. So it's used in situations like that, but it's not a moral stain on the child, because just because your parents did something they should or shouldn't have done, that's on them. That's not on you. So this is a purely legal category. In terms of human law, it says nothing about the moral quality or how much God loves you. God loves everybody, whether their parents were married or not. So that's the first thing to say about illegitimacy. The second thing to say about illegitimacy is that the way church law handles it, all children are automatically legitimate unless both parents entered into a marriage believing it was not a real marriage. So if either one of your parents entered the marriage in good faith, assuming that they're going into a marriage, and probably both of them did, then you're automatically legitimate. Illegitimacy would only apply if it turned out that neither your mother nor your father thought they were entering a real marriage. They were just simulating the sacrament. What if that were the case, though? Very unlikely as it would be to occur, what would happen in that case? Would you still be illegitimate? Well, maybe temporarily, but the law provides for legitimization. So just like if it turns out, oh, yeah, when dad had that affair and there was this other kid, that kid could be given full inheritance rights. And in the same way, under church law, if someone is illegitimate, they can be granted legitimacy under the law. So basically, this is just a bookkeeping thing. It's used for, among other things, like inheritance rights and stuff. It has nothing to do with the child's moral status or the status of the child in terms of God's love. God loves everybody, no matter who their parents were or what their parents did. And even for the vast majority of children whose parents do get an annulment, they're still legitimate because one or both of their parents thought this was a valid marriage at the time they were entering it. They weren't simulating the sacrament. And so the children born to that union are automatically legitimate. So that's kind of the lay of the land here, Mr. E.
All right, Mr. E, thank you very much for the question. Gabrielle wants to know this. How should we understand Jesus, quote, fulfilling the law, specifically considering the abandonment of many of the laws of the Old Covenant?
Well, Jesus fulfilled the law in two senses that are relevant here. The first sense is he brought the law to its true fulfillment in the sense that he clarified its true meaning. So, you know, what he did was, for example, interiorize the law. Now, most of the Old Testament laws deal with exterior behavior, like, you know, don't steal and stuff like that. But even then, there is some degree of interiorization in the Old Testament, like where the last commandment says, you know, not just don't steal, but don't covet something. Well, coveting is something you do inside with your heart. But that interiorization didn't really apply to most of the laws. For example, one of the things that you're not supposed to do is commit adultery. That's clearly part of the Old Testament law, but it doesn't say don't fantasize about committing adultery. You know, you could fantasize about it. You're not supposed to really want to. You're not supposed to really do it, or you're not supposed to covet your neighbor's wife, but you could fantasize about committing adultery the way the Old Testament law is written. But Jesus said, nope, if you look at a woman lustfully, it's the same as committing adultery with her in your heart. So he interiorized the law and prioritized the two great commandments, love of God and love of neighbor. And so he acknowledged that God had given the Israelites laws that were flawed, like he tolerated divorce among the Israelites, but he made clear that's not really God's plan. So Christ gave us the definitive revelation of God's law and thus fulfilled it in that sense. That's also the kind of fulfillment that's going on in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5-7, where he's given you the correct interpretation of the law and bringing it to fulfillment in that sense. But he also fulfilled it in a second sense, which was he obeyed it perfectly, and thus he brought it to completion so that he is, in Paul's words, the end of the law, so that later Christians are not obliged to become Jews. Even Jewish people are not obliged to keep the Mosaic law. And so this is something we read about, for example, in the book of Colossians, where Paul makes it clear that all of the Old Testament rituals were things that pointed forward to Christ, but now that the substance or Christ has come, the time for those things has passed away, and so we should focus on worshiping Christ and not, you know, offering rams and goats and pigeons at the Jerusalem temple. So those are the two basic senses in which the law is fulfilled. One, Jesus brought it to its consummation by revealing the true moral message underlying the law, and he also perfectly obeyed it and brought it to its termination in terms of its bindingness as a legal body. Now, morality is still legally binding on us. You know, we all got to act morally, but we're not obliged these days, and Jews included are not obliged to keep kosher or to, worship on Saturday rather than Sunday, or to have cities of refuge built into the land and stuff like that.
Gabrielle, thank you very much for the question. I'm going to keep going, try to get as many on as I can now that we're nearing the end. Library Dark Arts asked the following question. Prior to the fall, did Adam and Eve have preternatural gifts if they existed under the federal headship model or the polygenism model? If they did, what would have been the morality of human beings with preternatural gifts mating with human-like beings without preternatural gifts?
Okay. So the federal headship model is the idea that Christ serves as the representative of the entire human race. So, and this theory is particularly common in Protestant circles, but Catholics also may be able to make some use of it. So this is an explanation of, like, why are we guilty if Adam and Eve were the ones who sinned? And in the Protestant explanation, or a common, not the only, but in a common Protestant answer known as the federal headship model, well, Adam was the representative of the human race, and so his wickedness is imputed to each of us because he was our representative and he sinned. Catholics would not buy that formulation of it, because the church recognizes that we are not held responsible for Adam's personal fault. We suffer consequences from Adam's fault, but we it's not like God looks at us and punishes us the same way he would punish Adam, who personally was at fault. So it seems that Library Dark Arts is envisioning a related idea, which sometimes is talked about in Catholic circles, of what if Adam and Eve were two individuals who are part of a broader population, and they served as the federal heads of that broader population. So when Adam and Eve fell and lost sanctifying grace, the broader population lost sanctifying grace. Then polygenism is the idea that Adam and Eve are symbols for a broader population. So with those conceptual terms on the table, let's go back through the question. Prior to the fall, did Adam and Eve, in quotes, in Library Dark Arts quotes, have preternatural gifts if they existed under the federal headship model or the polygenism model? Well, under the federal headship model, if I'm interpreting Library Dark Arts correctly as meaning two individuals who are part of a broader population, then they might have had preternatural gifts. Preternatural gifts, so preternatural means apart from nature, what today you would call paranormal. So they, and theologians have speculated about what these paranormal gifts would have been. Basically, they would be superpowers, to keep it simple.
Okay.
If you had just a single Adam and Eve, they could have superpowers before the fall. If you have two individuals before the fall who are the federal heads of a larger population, yeah, they could have superpowers before the fall. And if polygenism is true and Adam and Eve are symbols of a broader population, that broader population could also, all of them, have superpowers before the fall. Who God gives superpowers to is a separate question than which of these models is true. So the idea of having preternatural gifts is consistent with all three of these models. He or she then says, if they did have preternatural gifts, what would have been the morality of human beings with preternatural gifts mating with human-like beings without preternatural gifts? Well, okay, the first thing is, how do we know that the human-like beings, like, say, let's say there were Neanderthals around, how do we know they didn't have preternatural gifts too? And how, you know, that we're talking at an early age, maybe God was generous with them as well. And how do we know they're even that Neanderthals and other early hominins are a different species? We don't really know that. They may just be a different kind of human, the same way we have different races today. There could have been just different races back then, and some of them are now called Homo sapiens, and some of them are now called Neanderthals, and some of them are now called Denisovans, and some of them are now called Floriansens, and so forth. But they may have all been one species before God, and they may have all had preternatural gifts. On the other hand, let's suppose they didn't, and let's suppose that they weren't all humans. Well, the issue of having preternatural gifts doesn't really affect the question. I mean, you can see that, for example, you can see that if you think about humans with preternatural gifts mating with humans without them. Add in the superpowers doesn't change the sex act. It's either licit or illicit. And the same thing is going to be true if they're mating with near humans. It'll either be licit or illicit without the preternatural powers coming into it.
What an interesting question, Library Dark Arts, and interestingly phrased as well. Jimmy Akin, thank you. I always enjoy the 2 hours with you.
Likewise.
Check out Jimmy Akin's podcasts, his various podcasts, including the Jimmy Akin podcast and Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. That will do it for us today. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.